Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 246. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about rock and roll and roller coasters and superheroes as we go to Northern Ohio. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have one news item for you, not a news story, but more of a personal nature. I've just accepted a new job at TripAdvisor as a director of engineering in the new initiatives group. That is going to affect this show and in ways that I'm not yet sure. We're working out a non-compete agreement, and it's quite possible that this will be one of the last episodes, or at least regular episodes, of the show, and I'll let you know more as things move along. It certainly won't be the last episode because I have already recorded the next episode, so you might want to tune in, and I'll let you know what I know. And I should say that that also probably means that the Egypt photo tour in November will, at least for the time being, be the last Amateur Traveler tour. So if you're interested, or if you were planning on waiting for the next one, there may not be a next one, at least anytime soon. So that is still available, amateurtraveler.com/tours. I'd like to welcome to the show Seth Oakley, who's coming to us from Columbus, Ohio, and coming to talk to us about vacationing in Northern Ohio. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And I have to say, and I think I've mentioned it once or twice in this show, I am by birth a Buckeye. I was born in the Buckeye State near Akron, Ohio, although I moved away when I was 3.5. So honestly, I couldn't tell you where to go for vacation in Northern Ohio. So I was kind of interested in this one. You pitched it. You're living in Columbus now, but you're not originally from there.
No, I grew up in Northern Ohio area. I want to talk about specifically a small town called Milan, Ohio.
Okay. And why did you pitch to me Northern Ohio? Why, this is not a place that is well up there in the travel brochures.
Well, that's one of the reasons. It has a lot to offer. We do have a regional tourist trade with a couple things I'm going to talk about, but I think it deserves a fair shot to get a little bit more coverage. The idea came from your show on Michigan, and there was some mention of Thomas Edison in that show. Well, Thomas Edison came from my hometown, Milan, Ohio. But like you, Chris, he moved away when he was young through his parents. But it got me thinking that I think your audience, you know, might enjoy a show on this area and learn a little bit about a place they don't know much about.
Terrific. Those are always the shows I enjoy. So if I come back to my roots, so go back to my homeland and go to visit Ohio, specifically Northern Ohio, what should I do? What kind of one-week itinerary would you recommend?
Well, I think there's a variety of things. It depends on what you're looking for. Ohio is kind of a microcosm of the U.S., so that's the way I like to think about it. It has dense East Coast-style cities with heavy industry and a lot of history. It has Midwestern farms. Western Ohio is flat and just the agricultural center of the state. Along the North Coast, what we call the North Coast, along Lake Erie, is a pretty laid-back island culture, lakeshore, kind of in the vein of, you know, sometimes they call one of the islands the Key West of the North Coast. It's pretty laid-back. And if you go down to the southeast part of the state, it's very hilly, and it is impoverished. It has a lot of the Appalachian background to it, but it's very beautiful, and some of the best hiking and trails are available down there.
And you mentioned Lake Erie, and that seems like that might be actually a good thing to talk about. I think a lot of us who grew up when I did, when we picture Lake Erie, we picture the way Lake Erie was in the 60s and maybe the 70s. which is a solid, as I recall.
Yeah, that picture has changed a lot. It at one point was considered in danger of dying. And what that means is all the life, the marine life and the plant life, was in danger of essentially dying off due to the number of industrial pollutants and even farm runoff. But the EPA kind of got wise to that and enacted a lot of legislation that banned chemicals throughout the country that were causing these severe water pollution problems. Another accidental thing that happened was the introduction of a new species of, they call them zebra mussels, and they're not native to Lake Erie. They're a little invasive, but they have a very positive side. They filtered the water. The way they eat is they filter the water. And the lake now is the best it's been, you know, in almost 100 years, some would say. It's cleaner and has a more diverse ecosystem. It is great shape. It's not considered polluted. It's very safe to swim. There's even surfing on Lake Erie. Near where I grew up, there was a group of high school kids that surfed almost every weekend they could, usually in the late fall and the late spring were the best times to surf when the wind was high.
And pardon the stupid question, but how big do the waves get on Lake Erie?
Surprisingly big. It's a very flat lake, very shallow lake compared to the other Great Lakes.
Aren't most lakes fairly flat?
I'm sorry, flat. The bottom is flat, not the water surface,
okay,
but the
right.
Lake bottom. And what that does is allow a long development of waves. So on a typical windstorm that would be good for surfing, 8 to 10 feet isn't unheard of, but 4 to 6 is more common. There's always a chop on that lake just because it is shallow enough. A wave can start on the Canada side and come all the way across, and it doesn't really get affected by the bottom since the bottom is so flat.
Interesting. Now, I interrupted you. You were doing more of an overview of the state before I dove into Lake Erie there, metaphorically speaking, that is.
We Midwesterners, we like to measure our state, our distances in units of time. So Ohio is about 4 hours wide and 4 hours tall. It's kind of a square. You know, on the south is the Ohio River, which goes from Pennsylvania to the Mississippi River. West Virginia and Kentucky are on the other side of that. And along the river in the south, it's very forested and very scenic.
I noticed that you are a Midwesterner, and that is very common. I don't know if you've noticed, but someone seems to have put your state in the east.
Yeah, that's very common. I think one of the reasons is it was one of the first states to really develop at the turn of the 19th century. Ohio was one of the first states to receive a lot of settlers. It was actually set aside by the federal government as land for people from Connecticut specifically that were affected by the Revolutionary War. Hmm. They were given soldiers land in general. Just if you fought in the Revolutionary War, you get 40 acres. George Washington actually surveyed the entire state. I don't know if it was after the Revolutionary War or before, but he did survey the state. But Ohio was the first area open to settlement for free by the government.
And that was before the war, when he worked as a surveyor?
Yeah, it was before. So Ohio was given to people affected by the Revolutionary War. North Central Ohio, the area I grew up, is specifically called the Firelands. And that was an area designated for people that lost homes in fires that were set by British soldiers. So there's a lot of reference to the Firelands in that area. Firelands Hospital, Firelands Electric Co-op. That name is very prevalent.
Interesting. I had not heard that before.
But because of its proximity to the east, it's only about 12 hours to New York City. That's really 10 hours. I've driven it 10 hours. It's only 6 hours from Washington, D.C., a little bit less than that to Chicago, to Toronto. So it's actually fairly connected to the East Coast. There are lots of flights out of Cleveland Hopkins International Airport all over the East Coast. Cleveland's also a major hub for Continental, now United Airlines, since they merged. It's going to remain as a major hub. So Cleveland is very well connected specifically to the East Coast, and people always make that link to the East Coast, but Ohioans like to think themselves as Midwesterners. Ohio became a state in 1803. It was number 17 in the list. It's also currently, I think, the seventh largest state in the country. It's highly populous. It always comes up during presidential elections because its population has a lot of electoral college votes. But anyways, back to the history. It started out as a kind of a transportation hub for the developing country. If things were going west, the Ohio River was the link to the west from the east. And Cincinnati was one of the biggest cities on the river. It became a very important hub to transportation. It wasn't until the railroads bypassed Cincinnati and went to Chicago instead that Cincinnati fell out of favor. Cincinnati could have been, had the railroad gone through, could have been Chicago. It could have been that important. But during the early 1800s, Cincinnati was where it's at. All the goods that were coming up the Ohio River and from the new farms in the Midwest, everything went through Cleveland. Cleveland was the big port on Lake Erie, where you'd load up the barges, they'd go up through the lock system and then across the Erie Canal and connect to the Atlantic Ocean. So the early industry of this country, Ohio played a very, very key role.
So I'm assuming we would start in Cleveland if I were to fly in, for instance, from California or from someplace further afield.
Yeah, Cleveland, although Toledo has an airport, I think Cleveland's a little bit more accessible, more flights per day, and it's a very large airport. So yeah, you would probably start in Cleveland, and the airport is kind of southwest of downtown, right on the interstate. So basically, to get to anywhere in Ohio, the interstate highway is probably your best bet. There really isn't a train system to get around. They're actually in the process of building one or getting funding to connect with the Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati with a high-speed rail, but we're years away from that. So the car is the way to get around outside of Cleveland.
I was thinking while we were talking about Ohio, and I forgot to mention it a moment ago here, we talked about Ohio being a microcosm of the United States. I believe it was in 1840, I just looked it up, where the phrase, as goes Ohio, so goes the nation, came up. That wow. Ohio was being used as a predictor of elections since that time.
Wow, I did not know that. That's pretty interesting, though, that it's been like that for so long.
So what should I do when I go to Ohio? I get off my plane or out of my car and...
Well, you're in Cleveland, so there's a couple things that, you know, I don't want to focus too much on Cleveland, but Cleveland has the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and it was pretty contentious when that was announced because New York kind of felt they deserved it, but Cleveland actually, a DJ in Cleveland originated the phrase rock and roll. It has had a long history of kind of like Detroit is associated with Motown, and New Orleans and St. Louis both have jazz. Cleveland was a hub for rock and roll. Because of that, they built the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so... Even though the induction ceremonies and the concerts always held in New York, Cleveland has all the memorabilia, has all the exhibits, and has all the interest. And people come, you know, I don't know how many visitors they get a year, but the Rock Hall is a very popular destination, and it grows every year in its patronage. Another thing you can do in Cleveland is Great Lakes Science Center. It's your typical interactive science museum, but it's actually one of the larger ones, and it's fairly popular. It's right next to the Rock Hall. So typically what I've seen families do is mom and dad go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then they send the kids over to the Great Lakes Science Center if they're old enough. They're right next to each other. It works out pretty great. Cleveland is also very highly into its sports teams. It's hard. We've been through a lot of heartbreak through the years. And with LeBron recently leaving, it just adds to the misery of Cleveland. So maybe one of these days we'll get a championship or one of our teams. But it reflects the attitude that sometimes Cleveland has, kind of the fatalistic. And I don't know if you listen to Prairie Home Companion Garrison Keillor.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. He talks about that Norwegian fatalism. I see that in Cleveland a lot just because of some of that stuff. And we've always talked about with the Cuyahoga River catching on fire and Lake Erie being what it was. It's always been kind of looked down on. But I'm 31 now, and Cleveland's always been on the rise since I can remember. It's a pretty interesting place.
So I apologize for how bittersweet the Miami show that we did last week must have been for you. So.
I saw that come in. I'm like, oh, come on, Chris. No, it's okay. Miami's a cool town. I was there last year, actually.
And so what should we do next?
I would head west out of Cleveland. West of Cleveland are, along the lakeshore specifically, are some pretty interesting towns. Milan, Ohio is, like I said, the birthplace of Thomas Edison. That's west of Cleveland. But there's also Sandusky, Ohio, which has Cedar Point Amusement Park. And Cedar Point Amusement Park is... kind of in the vein of Six Flags Park. Some of you may be familiar with that. It's more about the amusement rides and less about the experience and the theming like a Disney park. I don't want to compare it to Disney, but if you compare it to Six Flags, I think it's better. But Amusement Today, which is the leading amusement industry publication, has ranked Cedar Point Amusement Park the best amusement park for the last 12 years in a row.
And I think that is partly because of the roller coasters there, as I recall.
Yes, it is officially known as America's Roller Coaster. It has, currently, it has 17 roller coasters.
Oh, my.
And yes, including four over 200 feet in height, two over 300 feet, and the tallest one topping out at 420 feet. That one goes 120 miles an hour. It's called Top Thrill Dragster, and it's pretty intense. You're actually launched out of the station. You go from 0 to 120 and... gosh, I want to say under 3 seconds. It's ridiculous how fast you go. And you shoot up this big tower, and then when you're at the top, you can see, I mean, you can literally see Canada from the top of that ride. And not even on a clear day. And you come down, it's very thrilling. They have a history, though. The park has always been known for building record-breaking coasters throughout its history. The park actually started back in the late 1800s. I want to say 1870. It opened as a beach resort. I should explain that it's on a peninsula into Lake Erie, kind of a sandbar almost. It's about 300 acres, and it's always had a history of vacationing, and there's a white sand beach there that's pretty unique for Lake Erie. So it's always been a good destination. When it opened, it had some hotel rooms. It had, you know, the White Sand Beach, of course, a pretty sizable dance hall, which is still there in, you know, after a renovation, and a beer garden. But like any of those amusement parks, you know, I'm thinking of East Coast amusement parks like Coney Island and the like. It was basically driven by the economics of the time. So during the 20s, it was going great. It had a lot of success, but then the Depression hit and it kind of went downhill. World War II affected even more. And even into the early 50s, it was in danger of closing. It always had been a destination vacation place. It had a few rides. It had roller coasters. And then the 50s came along and they were considering making it housing, nice high-end housing. And the current owners came in and bought it and really developed it into what it is today. So starting in about 1950, they essentially rebuilt the park and expanded it from the 60s through now. And the 90s were kind of the heyday of roller coasters. They built a roller coaster every other year during the 1990s, and all of them were record breakers of some sort. Even in 1989, they built something called the Magnum XL 200, which was the first ride over 200 feet. They built a ride in 2000 called Millennium Force, which was the first roller coaster over 300 feet. And then in 2003, they broke the 400-foot barrier with Top Thrill Dragster. Yeah, it's just I've grown up with it in my backyard, literally, and people always ask, what's it like? Did you go every day? And I have to say, I did own a season pass for only 1 year, and having access to that every day, it kind of loses its specialness. I've limited myself. I only go once or twice a year. I'm usually with people that haven't been there before, and that's the best way to experience that place. It does change every year, but then to take someone that's never been and see how they react to the number of roller coasters. And it also has the most overall rides in the country as well. I believe there's 72 rides, including the roller coasters, but we're talking kiddie rides and dark rides, the pirate ride, all those kind of things. You can spend a good 2 days there. There's also a water park attached to it. It is a separate ticket. It's not included in the admission price, but it's a very, very sizable water park. And a lot of people will go for Cedar Point, ride their rides for 2 days, and then spend a third day at Stoke City, which is the water park. And fortunately, there are a lot of hotel options at Cedar Point right on the peninsula, as well as in Sandusky, which is the town that it's in. There's, at last count, I believe there are 10,000 hotel rooms in Sandusky, in the Cedar Point area, which is pretty incredible. But they receive over 3 million visitors a year is about their average. And they're only open from May till about October. Halloween is usually their closing date. So it's a very tourist-centric town because of that. There used to be industry in Sandusky. There used to be, I believe, a Ford plant. There used to be a lot of other heavy industry, and it's all gone. But the tourism trade has really kept Sandusky alive.
When they're open, what is the best time to visit Northern Ohio?
Summer, I would say. Summer and fall, weather-wise, are the best times. Summer is hot and humid. It's farther enough south that the heat and humidity are pretty oppressive, and it doesn't get the, the advantage of being on the lake is that you get a cool breeze, but in the summertime, the prevailing winds usually don't work that way. The springtime, although it's nice, it's also cold. Lake Erie is a thermal sink. Any of the Great Lakes do this, and it keeps that last like 5 miles close to the lake about 10 degrees cooler than everything else. So if you're a warm weather fan, springtime in Northern Ohio isn't always the best. But on the opposite end, fall is great because the lake is warm. The water temperature will get to 80 degrees in the summertime. Oh, wow. And it stays relatively warm through, even into November, you can have really pleasant days right along the shore and then go 10 miles south and it could be snowing. Wintertime, stay away in wintertime.
I would assume you get lake effect snow there.
North Central Ohio, it's not as often because the prevailing winds usually take it up east of Cleveland.
Okay.
But occasionally we do get lake effect snow. And when it does come, it's pretty intense. I've seen snowfalls growing up in the 18-inch to 2 feet range. Now they get worse than that east of Cleveland. They get 4 or 5 foot snowfalls at a time. But
sure. No, I had a roommate who grew up in Jamestown, New York, which gets some of that lake effect snow. And he said they routinely plowed the snow up to the telephone wires every winter.
Wow. Yeah, that's where we go skiing up in that area, actually. If we want a quick ski trip, we'll go up to that area of New York because they do get all that snow. And there's enough hills to make it worthwhile.
What should we do next?
Well, after you spend your couple of days at Cedar Point, I would go over to Put-in Bay. Put-in Bay is the main town on South Bass Island. There are a series of islands in Lake Erie. They're just kind of collectively known as Lake Erie Islands, but they include Kelly's Island, South, Middle, and North Bass Islands. Those are the ones with the major development. There's an island called Pelee Island, which is Canadian and probably 30 miles north of North Bass Island, but that's Canada. There are regular ferry services to all of those islands out of Sandusky. Detroit has a ferry over to Pelee Island. And another town called Port Clinton has a lot of ferry service to those islands.
Now, you said that very fast, but it's Put-in Bay. So this is where the explorers, I assume, put their canoes back in the bay or something.
You know, there's not really much of a bay there, so I'm not sure what the origin of the name. I bet it has something to do with that. But South Bass Island has been settled for, well, since the early 1800s. It's one of the older, more continuously settled islands on the Great Lakes. It was also the site of one of the major battles in the War of 1812. Oliver Hazard Perry, he was the American Commodore that was in command of the forces, and he was actually docked at Put-in Bay when the British launched one of their attacks in 1813. And defeated them. It was a 2 or 3 day battle, I believe, and he did defeat them. There's a historic phrase that came out of that battle. They call it the Battle of Lake Erie, but that was fought in Put-in Bay. Oliver Hazard Perry, the commander of the fleet, dispatched one of the most famous messages in military history. It read, "Dear General, we have met the enemy, and they are ours." They actually, during that battle, they took 2 British brigs, a schooner, and 1 sloop, and killed the supreme commander of the British fleet that was on Lake Erie at that time. It was a very decisive victory and led overall to the victory of the United States in that war. As a memorial, the U.S. erected a 352-foot Doric column on part of the island, and it's administered by the National Park Service currently, and it's like $4, and you can go to the very top and have a nice view of the lake. And of course, there's all that historic plaques. They actually give a nice overview when you're on top of the tower. They have a diagram that shows you where all the ships were at specific times and where the ships sank. I don't know if there's still any remains of the ships. Probably not at this point in the bottom of the lake. But it's interesting to know that that kind of history, that kind of key history of the United States happened right there, just a few miles out.
Well, as I recall, these are fleets that were all constructed on the lake, because if you think about it, they did not sail up past Niagara Falls. So
Right. They
weren't warships before the war, and they constructed warships on both sides and had this very famous battle.
Yep. Today, Put-in Bay is kind of a party town. Like I said before, it's kind of known as the Key West of the North Coast. It is very laid back, relaxed, and it's a destination for people that want to party. It's a very popular place for bachelorette parties, class reunions, college parties, you name it. It is... Well, I can't think of the number of bars, not because I've been there too much, but there's just so many bars along the main square of the town, including one that claims itself it has the longest bar in the world, several other bars that boast unique things. But on a Friday or Saturday night in the summertime, that is the place to party. The town square in the center is, I've known many people to sleep there, and the reason they have to sleep on the town square is because they miss the ferry back. There is all-day ferry service on both the Miller Ferry and the Jet Express, but if you're not on that last ferry, you're stuck. They do have bed and breakfast. There's some small hotels, and there's also a state park campground there. But those do fill up fast, and if you don't have a reservation or you're not prepared, then, hey, you just sleep right on the ground. It's very tourist-centric, so there are a lot of different restaurants, shops, and bars. There's even a small brewery over there. You know, I can't remember the name of it, but it has pretty good beer. They have a beer and wine festival every year in October, and that's when typically I would go. It's a little bit less crowded after Labor Day. I should say it's a lot less crowded. The fall season, it's still nice weather-wise, but it's when the locals go and enjoy it because it doesn't have all the out-of-town guests. And when I say out-of-town, I'm talking people from Cleveland and Columbus partying up there. That's out of town for Northern Ohio, at least on Put-in Bay. In the fall, it's all the Sandusky, and the people that are a lot closer enjoy it.
Any other sites that we should see before we start talking about more general overview?
Along with Put-in Bay, there are the other islands like Kelly's and Middle Bass. Those are less developed, but they're all the islands in general are pretty unique, is that golf carts outnumber the cars. Just because cars are expensive to take over there, and only if you're living there would you have a car. So most people get around on bikes or golf carts, and that's on all the islands. It's pretty unique. Kelly's Island has places to stay. It also has, they both have vineyards, as does a lot of North Central Ohio, even on the mainland. There are several vineyards, and one of the places I would recommend to eat and visit, it's a newer winery called Paper Moon Vineyards in Vermilion, Ohio, which is about 20 minutes east of Sandusky, right on the lake. And they are just getting started. So they are growing their own grapes. They're having their first actual wine from their own crops. I think next year they'll have it. They've been buying juice and then doing the fermenting themselves at this point. But what they're really gaining popularity in is their food. They have kind of like a tapas style menu. So you go there and you do wine tasting and you have your different kinds of snacks and hors d'oeuvres. They have live music. It's a very nice place and very popular. People are really raving about it. And because it's so new, it feels like almost like a hidden gem at times. So that would be one place I would recommend people go. It's a great family that owns it as well. So after you leave the islands, and of course you have to take a ferry back, I think the next destination will be Milan, Ohio. That's actually my hometown, but it's most famous for being the birthplace of Thomas Edison. He was born there in 1847, and he lived there until he was 5. His family then moved up to Michigan, but he did make an impact in Milan even in those early years. He started school at about age 4, and he was a bad student. He always acted out and rarely paid attention in class. another thing that Thomas Edison did, there's a painting of it. It's not just an urban legend. He was publicly spanked after setting fire to a farmer's barn in town. Milan was a shipbuilding center and one of the busier ports on Lake Erie. Now it's a small town of 2,000 people or so. But in the 1830s and 1840s, it was one of the biggest towns in the area. And it was heavy industry. It had a big grain shipping port, shipbuilding, like I said. In fact, one of the buildings around the town square used to be where they would build the ships and then take it by cart down to put it in the canal, which would then go out to Lake Erie. So they've since fitted the building out to have shops and offices on the second floor. But you can see a lot of the equipment, the original shipbuilding equipment is still in this building up in the attic. So overhead cranes and pulleys, all hand-hewn. It's pretty fascinating. The town, you know, I'm an architect, so I get into the architecture. Milan is a great collection of 19th century Georgian architecture. There's a lot of shipping magnates, owners of shipping companies and shipbuilding companies that lived in Milan. So, yeah, I want to say there's probably 20 really incredible houses kind of tucked away. It's not a big town, but they're still tucked away and they're grouped together. Just fantastic examples of Georgian architecture that you will see all over north central Ohio, but these are kind of taken to the next level since there's a lot of money involved with the people that own them. The town is arranged around a town square, similar to what you'd find on the East Coast in New England. And around the town square has always been the center of commerce for the town. But now it seems like antiques and those type of shops, there's a couple small restaurants, kind of make up the lifeblood of the town. And surprisingly, they draw a lot of people. And, you know, you always have that picture of the old people in tour buses show up and look at all the antiques. But beyond that, the antique shops actually do quite well and they make good money selling all types of antiques. My parents who still live in the area have sold stuff to the antique shops that later get resold, probably for a sizable markup. Milan also has something special, and during the Labor Day weekend, they have what's called the Milan Melon Festival. Ohio has a lot of small town festivals. A couple off the top of my head are the Bucyrus Bratwurst Festival, or the Marion Popcorn Festival, or the Circleville Pumpkin Show, and there's a great tradition of that.
You had me at the Bratwurst Festival, I think.
That was just last weekend, actually. Yeah, I know. The Bratwurst Festival is good, as is the Marion Popcorn Festival. This week, there's a Sweet Corn Festival. You know, I'm not sure what town it is, but almost every town of about 2,000 people or larger has a festival at some point during the year in Ohio. It just seems to be the thing that we do. The Milan Melon Festival is, you know, you can laugh about the name. They have a melon queen who rides around. Her float is actually a watermelon rind that she sits in. But it's named after the melon. There's a lot of farms around Milan that their crop is melons.
Hey, I grew up about 6 miles from where they crowned the artichoke queen. So really, I'm not throwing any stones here.
Okay. But yeah, the farming industry around Milan is pretty important. It's unique in that it's sandy. It used to be lake bottom. The bottom of Lake Erie used to come up a lot higher than it is now. So that soil is suited for a lot of things like melons and sweet corn, or popcorn, I should say, and grapes, actually. And like I said, there's that winery over in Vermilion that's pretty well known. Well, there's a couple other ones, just the Firelands Winery. And one thing they all specialize in is cold weather grapes. I probably should have mentioned this before, but they're known for their Rieslings, Pinot Gris, and I hope I say this right, Gewürztraminers.
Gewürztraminer, sure. So you're not talking about an ice wine, but just a wine that can grow in a colder region like the, so you're naming, for instance, grapes that are coming out of Germany mostly.
Yeah, so, yeah.
A colder region. Okay.
I'm trying to think. There's a couple. There's Lahn's Winery, and that's on Lake Erie Islands. There's Hermes Winery. And, you know, I'm sure I'm missing a couple. Those are kind of the major ones. There's also another wine region northeast of Cleveland that kind of grows the same kind of grapes. So a lot of people don't think of Ohio and think of wine, but it's a fairly sizable industry. I don't drink a lot of wine. I drink beer. But everyone tells me it's good wine. And on the subject of beer, I do have to put in a plug for Great Lakes Brewery out of Cleveland. They have a brewery and a pub in downtown Cleveland, but they're starting to get distribution outside of the state of Ohio. And they put out some pretty high quality beers. If you ever see a top beers in America list, Great Lakes always has a couple up there. And in fact, I'm drinking one right now.
And you in no way work for the brewery, I'm assuming this is.
I'm a supporter. I wish I could be employed there, but.
So as we start to go into more of the general overview section, what's going to surprise me when I go to Ohio, to Northern Ohio in particular?
Well, if you're going there for Cedar Point, you'll be surprised by Cedar Point. People that have never been there before or aren't from the area are always surprised when they see the scale and the just immense amount of things to ride and do and experience at Cedar Point. If you're not going to Cedar Point, I think the most surprising thing is just the variety that's available in Ohio and even in North Central Ohio, variety in terrain, the things to do. And the overall sense that you get from Ohio, from outside of Ohio, is that it's overlooked. It's only important during presidential election years, has that Cleveland kind of downtroddenness. But once you get there, you find that a lot of that is completely wrong. And it's a pretty nice place to go and visit. And it's rare, but some people come to live here after visiting.
And what's the best day you've had in northern Ohio? And did it involve bratwurst?
It did not involve bratwurst. But growing up there, I had a lot of good days up there. I'm trying to think, after I graduated college, I didn't have a job right after college. And that's when I had my season pass to Cedar Point. And I went up there on my own, went to Cedar Point just to kill a day. And I just talked to an incredible variety of people that I didn't expect to talk to while I was there. And the end of the night, I got a free ticket to one of their special rides. They have some upcharge attractions. This happened to be one of those slingshot rides. I rode with this lady. We just had never seen each other before. And the two of us, we just had such a good time. I haven't seen her since, but just that day in general and how it ended with that ride, because it was probably the most thrilling, exciting, and probably unbelievably crazy things I've ever done. It was a ride that drops you towards the ground 300 feet, and you're just basically in a tiny harness. And you stop and you slingshot back up, but it feels like you're stopping a foot away from the ground. It's probably a little bit more than that, but it feels like you're just going to hit the ground, and then you get swung back up in the air. And that just topped that entire day. It was one of the best days at Cedar Point because I didn't have to wait in line that much. There weren't big crowds, and everyone I talked to was just a fun time.
I'm just amused because you keep saying you go on this ride that drops you 400 feet or whatever. And I think, yeah, you go on this ride. Not me, sir.
But, you know, it is hard to say the best day since I did spend 20 plus years of my life up in that area.
Okay. What's the best day that I should come out of every day in the year? The best day to go to Northern Ohio is?
For me, because I want to avoid crowds and really get the best deals, it would be the weekend after Labor Day.
Okay.
Because everything's still open, because the season's still nice weather. All the kids are back at school, so you don't have that to deal with. There's a lot of discount. Places to stay are a little bit cheaper. They're not in their summer rates anymore, but everything is still open and available. So that's what I would tell people to go to Northern Ohio.
More so than the Melon Festival.
Well, you know, yeah, that's Melon Festival. I take that back. You're right. The Melon Festival is the best time to go. And I have to tell a story about the Melon Festival. There's a person or an individual that makes the Melon Festival a little more special than maybe some of the other festivals. And, you know, make all the jokes you want. I don't think they can do this at the Bratwurst Festival. But this person is known as Melon Man. He's the superhero of the town. No one knows where he came from, but every year he shows up. He literally has a watermelon helmet. He carves out a watermelon and wears it as a helmet. And then he has, you know, the green tights, and he has a whole uniform. It's hilarious. And I think he started coming 6 or 7 years ago, and he's always in the parade. They have a big parade on Sunday, and he comes and is in the parade. He was Grand Marshal a couple times. He is very popular among the children. They all love him, and he's also popular among the ladies. And I don't know if that has to do with his uniform or not, but it's a pretty special thing. But Melon Man is his catchphrase is, "The protector of all things good and fluffy." Why, I don't know. But his sworn mortal enemies are the abominable aphid and gopher guy are the two enemies. His comic book land. The Sandusky paper, the Sandusky Register, actually published a 2-page comic showing his battles and everything and saving the residents of Milan. It was, you know, for something that started where it did, you know, just a guy having an idea, it really blew up to something that's pretty funny. I mean, just overall.
Well, I normally ask, you know, if there is a memorable character or if there's a moment that you laugh and have to say only in Northern Ohio. I think we've covered both of those.
Yes, definitely.
Is there anything that the guidebooks miss with Northern Ohio?
Well, I've never read the moon. There's a moon guide to Ohio, and I haven't really read that one, but there's another one. The other guidebook that's pretty good is called Ohio, Off the Beaten Path, and that's by George and Carol Zimmerman. And that covers a lot of the unique things that I would assume the moon book, like I said, I haven't read it, the moon book doesn't cover. It talks about a lot of the back roads that are scenic drives that don't show up on maps. It talks about there's an Amish settlement in Ohio. Holmes County is near Akron, actually, kind of south of Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. My father worked for a business that was started by two Amish gardeners.
Oh, okay.
The Yoder brothers, as it very typically Amish name there.
Yes. There's a lot of Yoder products still around. There's Yoder cream cheese, and there's a roofing company in Columbus, Yoder Roofing. And actually, I work with a Yoder as well. That his family does trace back to that lineage. But down in Amish country, there's a lot of hidden things that aren't going to show up in guidebooks. But in Northern Ohio, Off the Beaten Path does talk more about Mylan than I think, you know, a lot of other, even websites don't bring up Mylan all that much, except for the ones that are connected to the historical museum and Thomas Edison's birthplace in Mylan. Off the Beaten Path talks about all that. So I would recommend that book. I was in Ohio and I read that and I learned a lot out of that book.
Okay. A couple questions for you.
Okay.
Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Northern Ohio when what?
When you see a guy wearing a watermelon on his head.
All right. And I guess the last question would be, if you had to summarize Northern Ohio in three words, what three words would you use?
Thrilling.
Okay.
History.
Mm-hmm.
And home.
All right. Well, Seth, thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and talking about Northern Ohio.
Thanks, Chris.
This is normally the part of the show where I would have comments from the community. There certainly have been comments and emails that have come in this week, but I'm just a little distracted, as you might imagine. So probably going to end this really quickly at this show. Again, next week, tune in. We're going to do a show on Chile that's already recorded. If you have any comments, feel free to leave them at amateurtraveler.com or send me an email to host@amateurtraveler.com. You can all follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, and I mean this very sincerely, and as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home.